This program was first broadcast on Arrow FM, Wairarapa's only community access media station, and shared on Access Media with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star
Safari.
Deep Sky Adventures.
In the universe.
Deep Sky.
Deep Sky Adventures.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari. Star
Safari. Wow, welcome to iSpace.
Welcome to iSpace.
So, what do we got going on in space?
Heaps of things. First of all, we're getting to that time of the year that came just after the longest night, when the center of the Milky Way goes right above its overhead or zenith. And it's the time of the year where we see more stars than any other time of the year, just after sunset. That said, we see a lot of stars all the time, but this time after sunset, the Milky Way center goes right overhead. And that's pretty amazing, because it is from this unique latitude here that we can see it, and nowhere else in the world.
That's right, and it's super impressive. So that bit of the Milky Way is like really, really wide that we see. And you often think of the Milky Way as a sort of thin cloud going, or thin cloud of all these stars going across the sky. But the center of it's actually really, really wide.
And the reason for that is that in the Northern Hemisphere, when the Milky Way band goes overhead, this is when we look towards the edge of the Milky Way. So it does look like a river. It does look like a road. It does look like a thin band of light going overhead. And so it was named accordingly. Whereas in the Southern Hemisphere, if you've been stargazing, you know that the center of the Milky Way is a big bulge of stars, about 40 billion stars that are concentrated in that central bulge region of the Milky Way, orbiting around our lovely supermassive black hole, Sagittarius A star. And so in here, when you look at the Milky Way, it looks different. It looks like a mountain. It looks like the surf of the sea, anything but a road. It looks absolutely spectacular. And if you have never seen the center of the Milky Way, you have to.
You probably have seen it, because if you live here and you've been outside and at night time, you probably have seen it.
Okay, for people who just moved here.
So it's super impressive, of course. And when you look up at it, you see these really rich star clouds, which are quite bright. And they're bright because that's the light from billions and billions of stars. I mean, it's really that many stars. It's a crazy number of them. And you also see these kind of dark patches in it, and those dark patches are dust that's in the way between that starlight and us. Now, it's not dust that's like in our atmosphere or anything like that. This is dust that's way out there in the galaxy. So it's clouds of dust. A lot of people think space is empty, but it isn't. It's, I mean, sure, there's not much stuff, but it's definitely not empty. You know, there's planets in it. You know, they're not empty. There's stars, but the gap between stuff is quite big. But there's also there's molecules, and there's gas, and there's dust that are just sort of free floating out there in space. If you were to scoop up like a cubic kilometer of space, you wouldn't find a lot of stuff, but there was definitely stuff there. There's definitely a few molecules of gas,
you scoop the cubic kilometer that has a star in it.
Yeah, then you get a lot of stuff.
So how big is a star?
Oh, really big.
How big?
Well, our sun's a star. Then that's a nearby one, very nearby. In fact, the closest one. And that star is 1.5 million kilometers across.
That's a lot of kilometers. That's huge.
Yeah, it is. And it's 1,300,000 times bigger than the Earth. So it's a staggeringly huge object. Super dense in the middle. If you could manage to transport yourself into the middle of the sun, the pressures are absolutely huge. The temperature's around 15 million degrees, which is crazy, crazy hot. The outside of the sun is about 5,500 degrees, which is roughly the same temperature as the very center of the Earth, you know, where the Earth's pressure is all concentrated and crushed down, and we've got this big lump of iron down there in the middle, but it's an immensely hot and under a huge amount of pressure.
We often talk to people at Star Safari, and one of the things that I hear almost on a daily basis is the fact I can't get my head around these numbers.
Yeah, well, I can. So I think that's people just don't want to. numbers are numbers. It doesn't matter how big they still work the same. They just have a different pile of zeros after them. And yeah, the numbers in space are really big because it's stuff we're not used to. But, you know, there's a lot of things out there in the universe we're not used to. We're not used to the temperatures. In fact, in Europe right now, they're not used to the temperatures they're getting. They're not astronomical temperatures. They're just a little bit higher than usual. So there's a comfort level to what we look at, I guess, around us. It's stuff that we know and we're happy with, we kind of get used to. But going out beyond that, it starts getting a bit trickier and people find it hard to sort of fathom. But the numbers in space, they're numbers. They're just not numbers. And you sometimes need a big calculator to look at them. But what do we know about stars?
So how small can you be? Like, let's talk about star sizes, right? So it's a really interesting subject. So how small can you be and still be a star? So for example, I remember when I was a kid, there were all these books circulating saying that, oh, Jupiter is a failed star. And now we know that's far from truth, but let's look into that a little bit.
Well, Jupiter, the physical size of Jupiter is roughly about the physical size of the smallest possible star. Now, the smallest possible star is a lot heavier than Jupiter. In fact, approximately, depending on whose paper you read, between 80 to 100 times the mass of
Jupiter.
Of mass of Jupiter. So Jupiter is just not quite heavy enough to be a star. So if you imagine Jupiter was 80 to 100 times heavier, but the same size, so really, really dense, then it would be able to sustain the nuclear fusion reactions in the core and then be a star. Now, Jupiter, and as you get bigger, imagine you had a Jupiter and you're sitting out there in space, you've got a really big Jupiter, well, a Jupiter, so not a really big one, the same size. It's about 10 times the diameter of the Earth. It's about 1,300 times bigger than the Earth. So imagine you've got 1,300 Earths. You put them in a blender, mix them all up, and tip them into a big sphere. That's a Jupiter.
Nice.
Otherwise, because if you got the spheres, there's all that space between them.
Yeah, so blender is good. I like
it. You need a big blender.
That's like the same thing. Like if you put Saturn in a big bathtub, right?
Yeah.
The same series.
We won't go into the physics of the bathtub and just how that would actually have its own gravity.
The blender.
And would collapse under its own weight. But anyway.
So let me get this straight. So if you have a few Jupiters and you squash them, so if you put two Jupiters next to each other, they're not going to be just two Jupiters next to each other. They would get squashed.
Well, here's the interesting thing. So Jupiter's big. If you go tipping more stuff into Jupiter, it doesn't get physically bigger. It just gets denser and heavier because what's happened is all that stuff goes in, but of course it collapses more under gravity. It gets pulled in tighter. So you can tip more and more and more stuff into Jupiter and it just gets packed in tighter and tighter and tighter. Now, there is a point when you start getting nuclear fusion happening in the core and it's not sustained. So it's not the nuclear fusion that's going on in a star, but you start getting sporadic nuclear fusion. You get different types of nuclear fusion that lasts for a bit, doesn't keep going. So it's not enough to sort of start that balance you get in a star, what we call hydrostatic equilibrium. But you end up with something, what we call a brown dwarf.
It's like when you crank up an engine.
Yeah. So it's not quite a star. It's too big really to be a planet. So we've got this interim thing, which roughly kind of starts at about 10 times the mass of Jupiter and goes up to when you can start actually having a star. And that's, we call those brown dwarfs. So these are kind of objects that are a bit too big to be planets, not big enough to be stars. And actually, we find quite a lot of them. There's a few around, and we're finding them all over the place.
Can you see them?
Yeah, well, you can see them, just not with a regular telescope they have in your backyard. You can normally see them through infrared because they do generate a little bit of heat, a little bit of light, and you can pick that up.
Can you see them with binoculars?
No.
Silly question.
No. Not unless you had a binocular, like real big ones, say 100 meters for one eye and 100 meters for the other one. Yeah.
Like the Great Binocular Telescope.
Yeah, but yeah. Like 10 times bigger. Yeah. So Jupiter's interesting in that respect because it's the physical size of the smallest possible star, yet it's only about 1% of the mass. So
I'm quite fond of Jupiter, not because it's not the most beautiful planet.
It's pretty cool, though.
Not because it's the largest planet in our solar system, but because it formed first. It was the first planet to form, as far as we know.
Well, you say it's not the most beautiful planet, but isn't it beautiful? What is the most beautiful planet?
Saturn.
Just because it's wearing
Saturn.
Just because it's wearing
Saturn is
jewelry.
The most beautiful planet.
It's just because it's wearing jewelry.
By right? far, yes.
So if it wasn't wearing
jewelry, it's a woman thing.
So if it wasn't wearing jewelry, would it be beautiful?
No, it would be actually
be ugly, right?
It would be very, very boring, actually. Saturn, if it didn't have the ring, it would be very bland. It's just a button. It doesn't even have many clouds.
But it's squished a little bit, isn't it?
Like Uranus has more clouds. But no. Oh, look, actually, Saturn has a
Uranus
hexagon.
Uranus has rings.
Hexagon.
There's fine.
Saturn has a hexagon.
True, yeah, which is pretty amazing.
Pretty amazing, yeah.
Like, Neptune has rings too. Well, Jupiter has rings as well. They all got rings.
Yeah, Jupiter has rings in infrared, though.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
Saturn's one's just more spectacular.
Yeah. Saturn's is just... incredible.
But Jupiter's cloud bands are pretty spectacular.
I'm very fond of Jupiter. I am, because here is this amazing planet that, as far as we know, formed first, and it didn't even form where it is right now. It formed a little bit closer, and as it was forming, the story goes that the protoplanetary disk where it was forming had a little bit of drag and dragged Jupiter closer. It dragged Jupiter almost as close to the orbit of Mars, and it created havoc in the early solar system. It got everybody to bang into everybody else. Maybe that's why we have the moon, because a planet called Theia got pushed away from its orbit and smacked into the Earth. Half of it is still inside Earth.
How do we know it was called Theia?
Well, we called it Theia in retrospect.
We just made it up.
We just made it up. Yeah. And then Jupiter, as it was doing this, kind of like dragged the other planets on the outside of the solar system, and then those planets, Saturn in particular, pulled Jupiter away from where it was in the orbit of Mars and all the way to the orbit in which it is today. And I find this incredibly fascinating because it just talks about how dynamic our solar system is. But regardless, Jupiter is not a failed star. It's just a planet.
Yeah, well, it never really was a failed star. It simply doesn't have the mass, anywhere near the mass, to be a star. And by the time it started sort of concentrating all that mass, eventually it ran out, and it was never going to load it anymore because the stuff had gone. What's really interesting about our solar system, so now we see lots of other solar systems. I think there's something like 3,000 or so other solar systems that we've found out there.
That 7,000 exoplanets confirmed, yeah.
So that's a lot of other places. Now, what we see with these other solar systems is they don't, we haven't found any that seem to be as stable as ours. What sort of marks our solar system was two things, really. One, it's really close, so we can
see stuff.
Yeah, and we can measure it really easily. All the other ones are so far away that it's quite hard to measure them in a great deal of detail. But there's enough that we can look at. And what we see is them in all sort of strange configurations. There's the gas giants are closer to their stars than some of the rocky planets, which is kind of the opposite to our solar system. There's a bunch of like Neptune-y type planets out there, but they don't all seem to be in the same configuration that our solar system is. And our solar system's what's remarkable about it is just how long it's been so stable. And so if we're thinking about life on planets, that stability seems to be fairly important, especially here on Earth, that stability for 3.5 billion years has possibly made those conditions for life a lot more ripe than in some other solar systems that we see.
Yeah, it's quite staggering. And so we come back to thinking, how lucky are we Every time I learn something about this kind of stuff, I think, how lucky are we here on Earth? So many things had to happen for us to exist, and including Jupiter traveling in and out of the inner parts of the solar system, and dragging all of these planets along. As we know today, Jupiter has 101 moons, which is a lot of moons.
Yeah, it's probably got a lot more. Mind you, the ones we're finding now are quite small, only a few kilometers across. So we are sort of, scooping at the bottom of the barrel. The big ones are being found. The cool ones, the ones that are spectacular with craters and all that stuff on them. Now we're down to large rocks, really. Very large rocks. You say it's about luck, though, but luck implies that it's because of us, or are we because of it? Because of the way the universe has dealt out these cards that have provided, from a statistics point of view, these hundreds of billions of trillions of stars that are out there, one of those stars, the sun, the one we call the sun, just so happens to have a nice stable solar system that's made the conditions for life quite conducive. And more recently, really recently, us. To me, it's not luck because luck implies it's about us. Actually, that isn't about us. It's the universe.
Yeah, I mean,
It's a bit bigger than us.
luck is luck, right? It's not like it
You could
doesn't
say
really
lucky
take
for
special
us.
lucky for
It
us. Yeah.
was lucky for the dinosaurs for a while.
So coming back to stars, red dwarfs are really tiny stars, and they're the size of Jupiter. And then you can have on the other side of the spectrum, really large stars.
Well, so the smallest stars are around 8% of the mass of the sun. So that's pretty tiny. Our neighboring star, Proxima Centauri, is about 16% of the mass of the sun. So that's a tiny little star. So if you sort of think about that for a moment, our neighboring star is a red dwarf and you can't see it. You can't go outside and sort of point, oh, look, there's Proxima Centauri. It's just too dim. You just can't see it. You actually need a decent powered telescope to pick it up. I don't know what its magnitude is. I think it's somewhere around 14 or 15,
Yeah.
which is really, really faint.
It is really faint.
Yeah. Like if you went outside and you want to look at well, it's Uranus is about 5.5, isn't it? Its magnitude, something like that. And
And
that's a pretty faint planet. You can't see it very easily. So our eye in ideal conditions, you can see down to magnitude 6. So something that's magnitude 14, 15 is really dim. So each magnitude is, as you go up the numbers, so between 6 and 7. So 7's 2.5 times dimmer than 6, and 6 is 2.5 times dimmer than 5, and so on and so on and so on. So you can imagine by the time you get to magnitude 14, something's pretty dim. And so you need quite a powerful telescope to see that. So routinely in our telescopes, we can see objects down to about magnitude 13, magnitude 14. So even Proxima Centauri is getting to the limit of what we can see.
Yeah, it's really hard to see. I think I've only seen it once or twice, a long time ago. And then more interesting to look at is Alpha Centauri, which
Yeah,
is the
way bright.
next closer neighbor, and it looks amazing. So
So that's one we default often to say for the
yeah.
neighbor is Alpha Centauri because it's easy to spot. And it is pretty close. It's, Proxima Centauri's 4.1 light years and Alpha Centauri's 4.3 light years. So they're both pretty close. And it's a good proxy for the neighbors. It's kind of the neighbor's neighbor if they were living, close.
So I'm gonna be the 8-year-old student from the schools that we're going to, and I'm gonna ask you about the largest star.
No, they don't. They always ask about Uranus. Who are you trying to kid? There's only one planet that they care about.
Let's go back to the stars.
Okay, back to stars. What are you asking?
What's the biggest star?
The biggest star. Well, it's Stephenson something, isn't it? Yeah. The biggest one that we look at routinely is VY Canis Majoris, and that's in Canis Major. So you can see that one.
And we also look at Eta Carina.
Yeah, which is huge, but by mass, so physical size, I'm not sure. That's a hypergiant. Betelgeuse, of course, is the other real big one that's reasonably close. That's 1,000 times the diameter of the sun. So that's 1.5 billion kilometers across. That's pretty huge.
So this Stevenson star, last time we checked, it was so large that it was going all the way to Saturn.
Yeah, so what is it, 2,500 times the
One,
diameter of the sun or something?
don't know.
Yeah.
A lot, like 1 point, what, 1.5 billion
Well, it must be because Saturn's
kilo.
about 1.2 billion kilometers away. So that's a radius of nearly 2.5 billion K, right? And so Betelgeuse is 1.5 billion. So it must be getting up around, a radius of, pretty huge.
Pretty huge, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So almost twice the radius of Betelgeuse. Wow, that's a big star.
That's a big star. But is this like a technically, is it a star? Because it's a giant star, right? So it's a star that has finished its main sequence.
Well, it's a star because it's got nuclear fusion happening in the core.
Still happening.
Yeah. Now, it might be a bit messy and a bit bloated. And of course, stars aren't, they don't spend their whole lives like this. They start out all nice and compact and fusing hydrogen into helium. And then once they run out of hydrogen, that's when things start going crazy. So they sometimes swell up really big, like Betelgeuse is doing at the moment, and the star Stephenson. They go real, real big. And then they can contract again as they start fusing other stuff further up the periodic table. And then they can expand again and contract again and expand again. Ultimately, though, it's over pretty quick for them once they get to that end.
So these two stars that we're looking at, VY Canis Majoris, which is pretty amazing, which is a red hypergiant, and you can actually see it a little bit orange,
It does, yeah. It looks quite orange, doesn't it, when you look
and
at it?
Eta Carina.
Well, Eta Carina, that's huge. That actually looks more yellow, though, doesn't it? But that's, yeah, that's, well, it's got a
Well,
little stack
it's a
around it.
binary star.
Yeah.
It's a binary star, so maybe one of them.
Yeah.
So VY Canis Majoris is about 4,000 light years away, and Eta Carina is about
Right there.
8,500 light years away. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing stars.
So the one you can see at the moment, of course, is Eta Carina, which is pretty cool. And that's in a bit of the sky, reasonably close to the Southern Cross, not too far from it. And so you can see it quite easily. But what you see around, of course, is a really spectacular nebula, nebula being a gas cloud.
Which is, you don't see that around VY Canis Majoris. And actually,
Yeah.
VY Canis Majoris, as large as it is a little bit disappointing because all you can see, it's a red dot. And it's actually almost half the distance that Eta Carina is. And you just see this tiny little dot, whereas Eta Carina, it's one of the most amazing star fields and regions in the night sky that we're looking at with a
Well,
telescope.
that comes down to the luminosity. So Eta Carina is 4 or 5 million times the luminosity of the sun, whereas VY Canis Majoris is just a few hundred thousand, just a few hundred thousand, a few hundred thousand times the luminosity of the sun.
5 million times more luminous than the sun.
Yeah, and that's why it's so much brighter
Wow.
at almost like twice the distance. It's yeah, it is, I mean, these things are staggering. Imagine something 5 million times brighter than the sun.
It's coming back to those statements. It's really hard to get your head around these
Well,
numbers.
no, the number you've got to get your head around is, so for the sun you need SPF 50, right? So for Eta Carina you're
Is
going to
this a
need
logarithmic scale?
SPF 90 billion. I don't know,
And
something real. Like lead.
is this a logarithmic scale?
Yeah.
So, I was reading in a book, in an astronomy book, and that's just a side comment that someone was saying there, one of the people who was writing the astronomy book, that they don't know why the logarithmic scale of magnitudes was made like that as a logarithmic scale, and that person personally would have had it taken away from teaching, but because it is traditionally taught like that. So magnitudes are brightnesses of stars. And so you look at stars and some of them are brighter and some of them are less brighter. And so I thought it was a very interesting comment from that person. But what's really interesting about the logarithmic scales in general is that our senses are designed in logarithmic scale. So if something
designed,
well, not designed, like not designed, yeah, not the grand design. We have been selected for to see brightness logarithmically, to hear sounds louder or slower logarithmically, and to see, to feel pain logarithmically, which is really, really interesting. So the logarithmic scale refers more to our senses than so that's how it makes sense to why these things exist.
Yeah, well, that's right. So when you're talking about magnitude, so when we measure stars, we actually measure a thing called absolute magnitude. So that's how bright the star is at a certain distance, and that's what we call the absolute magnitude. So the sun's absolute magnitude, what is it, 24 or something, isn't it?
I think so. Shame on us.
Can't remember the top of my head. And Eta Carinae's absolute magnitude's around 6 or 7. So it shows you the difference. And remember, each one of those magnitudes is 2.5 times different. So that's a kind of like a logarithmic one. And that equates to like 5 million times. So in some ways, it seems like if you're thinking about numbers, logarithmically, it's easier to talk about them like that. But then unless you actually understand logarithms, it's hard to conceptualize what they are. So that's why when we go back to something like 5 million times is easier to kind of conceptualize than a magnitude. Mm. You've got to convert it into something that means something, if that makes sense.
Totally does.
Yeah, yeah.
And with this lovely thought, our time has come to an end for this episode. But no doubt we will find more amazing stellar subjects to explore.
So get outside and remember to go and have a look at Matariki early in the morning. So get up early and have a look at that. And we hope you have clear skies for that. So see you next time on Why Space.
See you next time.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star
Safari. Safari.
Deep Sky Adventures.
In the universe.
Deep Sky.
Deep Sky Adventures.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari. Star Safari.